I want to thank you all for attending and for taking part in our second session of our speakers. The second session is our town hall meeting where we have state, local, and federal representatives talking about alternative fuels in our area and what is to come in the future. So our very first speaker that we have is Mike Graney. He's from the Oregon Department of Energy. He's going to be the moderator for this segment, and he's also going to tell you about tax incentives and what other incentives there are to switching to biofuels. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all to this session, a town hall meeting called A New Energy Future. It sounds a little like the original Star Wars movie, A New Hope, but I think instead of talking about a long time ago in a galaxy far away, we're going to be talking about our future. We have a fine panel today of local, state, federal, and industry officials, and they'll discuss issues facing the increased development and use of biofuels in our state and in our Northwest region. In keeping with the town hall theme, we'll try to keep at least 30 minutes available for your comments and for you to ask questions. Earlier this year, Governor Ted Kulongoski adopted a Renewable Energy Action Plan. That plan went through a number of drafts over the past year after we received input from hundreds of citizens. The Renewable Energy Action Plan provides targets and actions to increase the development and use of renewable energy in Oregon, and biofuels is a major focus of that plan. Here are some of the goals of the plan regarding biofuels. The 15 million gallons of biodiesel will be produced annually from Oregon crops, products, and waste oils collected in Oregon. The 100 million gallons of ethanol be produced annually in Oregon. The 25% of the diesel used by state government fleet vehicles will be B20, or 20% biodiesel by 2010, and all of the diesel used by state government will be at least B20 by 2025. 10% of the gasoline used by the state will be E85, or 85% ethanol, by 2010, and 25% of that fuel by the year 2025. There are other targets as well. These are ambitious targets, but they can be met. Let me mention some of the tools we have to help meet these targets. Our energy loan program, which has financed over $200 million of renewable energy, can provide low-interest loans for ethanol and biodiesel production facilities, for infrastructure for distribution and storage, and funding for fueling stations and other equipment. Our business energy tax credit, which has helped businesses invest over $130 million in renewable energy, can also be used for ethanol and biodiesel production facilities and other infrastructure. Companies with little Oregon tax liability, as well as nonprofit organizations, transit districts, and local governments, can partner with a company which has tax liability to get the benefit of that tax credit. And farmers who produce material for ethanol or biodiesel production can use the tax credit for capital and equipment expenses related to the production of that feedstock material. Let me give you a couple of examples of how these incentives have been used. Sequential Pacific Biofuels is using these incentives for a new ethanol and biodiesel retail fueling station in Eugene that will open early next year. Sequential also recently opened a biodiesel production plant in Salem, the prequel to a much larger facility that will open in Portland next year. And the state motor pool in Salem has installed an ethanol refueling station for its growing fleet of E85 vehicles. The legislature considered a number of bills this past year to help biofuels further, and two important bills were enacted. Senate Bill 735 makes it easier for our energy loan program to finance renewable energy projects, including biofuels. This will help us work more effectively with ethanol and biofuel developers. Senate Bill 736 expands an existing exemption process for large biofuel production facilities. Under the prior law, the Energy Facility Siting Council, our citizens panel, which licenses large energy facilities, could issue an exemption for ethanol production facilities which meet certain conditions to protect the environment, but only if they used grain, whey, or potatoes. Senate Bill 736 expands this exemption to cover ethanol facilities from any farm or forest material. The bill also provides the same exemption process to biodiesel production facilities. This exemption process allows our siting council to complete its review in about 2 months compared to the nearly 1 year a review normally takes. Currently, we use over 60 million gallons of ethanol a year, but all of it comes from the Midwest. We could change that and use locally grown products and agricultural and forest waste for ethanol and biodiesel. and we would give a boost to our local farmers. Increased use of biofuels will help improve our air quality, reduce our dependence on foreign sources of oil and other fossil fuels. Biofuels can also help our local economy by helping our local farmers and create more jobs producing energy in Oregon. And biofuels may well end up costing us less than oil and other fossil fuels as the pressure on fossil fuels continues to rise. We have an opportunity to change our energy policy and improve the quality of our lives. It is rare we are given such an opportunity with so many benefits if we make the right choice. I know all of you here today have made that choice already, and with your efforts, we can succeed. Thank you very much, and thank you for being here. Let me now turn to our first panelist, Rex Burkholder. Rex Burkholder is a Portland Metro Commissioner. He serves as Vice Chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation and serves as the Metro Council's liaison to the Bi-State Transportation Committee and to other regional transportation committees. He also served as a member of Governor Kulongoski's Advisory Committee on Global Warming. He received a bachelor's degree from Portland State University and a master's in urban and environmental policy from Tufts University. Please join me in welcoming Commissioner Rex Burkholder.
Hi. How's everyone today? Great. We have a fairly small group, so I'm going to be kind of conversational about this, but my job here is really to talk about what's the big picture here and about transportation and land use. And so we're going to talk a bit about those challenges that we have and then ask you to participate in what we call a new look at the regional land use and transportation planning. I have some informational flyers here about that. Because Portland is like it is, the Portland area is like it is because of choices people have made in the past. And what, do I just do this to change slides? Okay. How do you like that? Okay. In 1994, there was a new charter adopted for the Metro government. And the charter said, let's plan for the future and have Metro develop a long-term 50-year plan for the future of the region, because there was concern there that we had started reaching out to the edge of the urban growth boundary and started sprawling onto farmland. So there was something that's called a 2040 concept was developed and adopted. And the basic concept was, how do we use the land inside the urban growth boundary more efficiently so that people can get what they need, live in their communities without having to travel a lot, and protect that farmland around it. And I'm going to talk about some of those basic components of that plan and then talk about what are the challenges to that plan and what's happening today. So we'll change slides. So the concept here, again, it's a 50-year vision, 2040. It started in the early 90s, so he said 50 years, guys, to 2040. It's about time to reconsider that one. The idea was to take advantage of the high-capacity transit we've been developing, the light rail, the buses, those types of high-frequency buses, and build up these centers. And then that was actually this vision, which this map, it just shows a little bit of the region here with purple blobs. Those are areas for higher density of development. The center city's there in the middle. And then the rest of the areas have various different densities that were designed, and those were implemented on the local level. Go ahead, next slide. So one of the key pieces, of course, is building up these urban centers, are walkable, bikeable communities where people can meet their needs without having to jump in a car, whether it's powered by gasoline, diesel, biodiesel, whatever, but the idea that you're trying to create communities that function without having to move around as much. And it included things like mixed housing and having lower amount of parking for automobiles so that there's more land there for developing. Next one. A big piece of this is making sure the center city stays healthy. And we'll just keep whipping through this just to give you background. One of the examples of the success of that is that we had, actually it's up to 5,000 new residents that have been moved in to the Pearl District in downtown Portland. There's also a lot of new housing being built in South Waterfront. We're discovering that there is a large market. A lot of people do want to live in those higher density neighborhoods. Next one. Part of that, too, is a way to try to maintain the economy as well as reduce travel is to protect industrial areas near the city. So Swan Island, Columbia South Shore, industrial areas in Hillsboro. They actually try to protect those so people's jobs and housing are close to each other, a key component of reducing the need to travel. Go ahead. Again, it's looking at how do we protect and not sprawl from here to Salem with the kind of the number of people moving here. And then also the idea, part of this idea is also to give a sense of difference. As you leave one community, you can actually notice that you're out in the country before you go, say, from Gresham to Sandy. Keep going. Part of that, yeah, just one more time. I don't know why they're not showing up. Part of it, too, is that when you ask people to live closer to each other, it's really important that they have access to open spaces and green spaces. So parks and neighborhoods, natural areas, streams, and we have a mixture of purchasing, next slide, purchasing land for protection in the long run, and we've bought a little over 8,000 acres with your money in the last 10 years, and we're looking at putting another bond measure out in next fall in order to be able to do that, do some more of that. But it's also through some regulatory protection of stream sides and natural areas within the urban growth boundary. Travel options, this is related to the theme of the conference today, this is a real critical component of this, is that we should have, everybody should have a choice of how they get around, whether it's driving a car, walking, biking, using transit. The idea is, do we have a system that actually works, that's full of all the choices that people need to meet their daily needs? And one key piece of this is creating neighborhoods that work. In the past, highway designers and road designers basically had one goal in mind. They built roads to move cars faster. And that usually meant you get rid of sidewalks, you don't have bike lanes, you don't have curb extensions. And so part of this is in these areas, these centers, is to develop these street designs so that people feel more comfortable walking around. And actually, we found that it really helps the local businesses as well, because once you do park your car, if you drive, once you park your car, you can actually cross the street. And so you actually go to the stores on both sides of the street instead of feeling like it's too dangerous to cross. And this is a major issue. That's how we fund a lot of our transportation dollars now go into making sure that roads and streets are safe for people to walk and bike and attractive as well. And another big piece of this is light rail. The first light rail was built in 1986 with dollars that were actually taken from a freeway project that was stopped by the citizens in southeast Portland. It was to be a Mount Hood Expressway that went from what's the Markham Bridge. If you go across that bridge, you see there's some stubs of off-ramps that were never built. And there was a freeway to go where Powell Boulevard is now all the way out to Highway 26. That was stopped by neighborhood activists, and the money was held onto and used partially to build the first light rail line in 1986. Now, that's expanded quite a bit. Go ahead, next one. And you can see the system that's in place today, including the light rail that comes here, but there's also light rail, hopefully, going across to Vancouver. And then in a couple years, we're going to start the next project, which is going to Clackamas from Gateway. And the idea, you build a skeleton framework of high-capacity transit that people can use other buses to access or ride their bikes to and take their bikes on as well. And that provides a good network of high-speed movement around the region so you don't have to get in your car as often. Next slide. So the question is, did this stuff work? We've been doing this quite often. In the 1970s, there was actually 3 months of the year, 90 days, not 3 months all in a row, but 90 days out of the year where it was considered dangerous for older people or people with respiratory diseases or children to go outside. Okay, that's just 30 years ago. And the combination of these activities plus cleaning cars up has made it so that we haven't had a bad air day in the last, I think, 3 or 4 years. And actually, we're now considered what the Environmental Protection Agency calls an area in attainment. And therefore, it helps us a lot in terms of our federal transportation dollars as well. Another big issue is, and this map looks like spaghetti, but we'll take just a little time to look at this graph here. When you look at the cities around the country, we see that VMT means vehicle mile traveled. So this is the average person. How many miles a day do you drive your car? And when you're looking at Kansas City's, the top yellow one, you're up to almost 30 miles a day that each individual has to drive. And you have a variety, and the wiggles are usually based on local economic impacts, that you have, if you have a bad economic year, your amount of traveling goes down. Portland's this one down here on the bottom here, and it's the only city in the country where people's driving that they have to do has dropped. So when you look at the number of times that people get on the highway yourself, and how much you have to drive in Portland, because of travel options, because of jobs being closer to homes and such, we actually are finding that people are driving a lot less. And that is definitely much less than the national trend, which is, so it's another sign of a positive change that's happened in this area. Now, the next slide says, is it enough? And we're going to flip through these really quickly. Okay, this is our projection. The growth rate is going a lot faster than we thought. Portland is a great place to live. I don't think people are having more children, but people are moving here at high rates. So we're going to go on and say, what does this mean? Portland is the same thing as, next slide, two more Portlands. So 1.1 million people has got two more Portlands. Next slide. Or, keep going, 14 more Hillsboroughs, or, this I like, 54 more Milwaukees. Okay, this is in 25 years, if the growth rates continue, we will have this 1.1 million more people in the region. A big challenge, and especially if we want to preserve the quality of life we have here today, and also if we want to protect the farmland that surrounds the region, et cetera. So the next slide is, okay, we're talking about cars here today, we're talking about moving around. If you add these numbers up, there's about 8 parking spaces for every car. That's off-street parking spaces, not on-street. That's what we have about today. And there's about 1 registered vehicle for every American. Okay, we're the same here. And so another 1.1 million cars, I did some math. I'm not going to guarantee this number because I didn't ask any person who really knows what they're doing about this. But it comes out to about 40,000 acres that we'd need to park those cars. And that's 63 square miles. Now, we had an urban growth boundary expansion 2 years ago. That was the biggest urban growth boundary expansion we've ever made in this area. And it was considered a very, very big deal. It was 18,000 acres. And we added land in the southeast part of the region and other around the area, but 18,000 acres. This is over double the amount of acreage we added to the urban growth boundary just to park those cars if everybody still drives as much. Another issue, keep going through this one, is global warming, obviously. There's a major issue that we emit carbon dioxide in our automobiles. It's the major source of carbon dioxide and global warming gases in Oregon. It's 40% or so of that. We'll just keep going through these. These things you may know, just numbers showing that growth. I lost my picture. I had a cartoon in here to lighten things up because it got kind of depressing here. Some of the issues that we... I also work on a Macintosh. That's kind of like a biodiesel car. A Macintosh that doesn't go along with anything else, right? What we have, these are some of the issues that may happen here. And one of the issues I think that is a major one is the second one here, I think, for us, is that we actually may see, because of the rest of the world and the rest of the country, at least the models that I saw as part of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Global Warming, we'll actually see the other parts of the country are going to be much more impacted than we are. And so we actually might get higher migration rates than we can imagine because we can't close the borders to people, say, from Atlanta or from Florida or north of New Orleans, for example, as well. So we'll go on the next one here. Let's see that I lost my cartoons. Okay, let's keep going. Oh, shoot. Okay, those two other slides is an issue that I'm sorry about the slides not showing up. I'm not sure why they didn't. Is about peak oil and fossil fuel depletion. You know, there's questions about have we hit peak oil in the world already, or is it in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years? I don't think it really matters to us. What we know is that the demand is rising at a very high rate compared to how much oil is available, and therefore we're going to see prices of petroleum-based oil going up, and that's going to affect our ability to move around already. Oh, there's my cartoon. It came back. Good. We already know that the cost of transportation is the second most highest cost to a family next to housing. Housing is about average about 30% of a family's income, and about 20% is transportation. And Portland area, actually, we are doing better than the rest of the country because the average family spends about 15% of their family income on transportation in Oregon, which is about 20% less than the rest of the country. But it's still about $7 billion a year that we spend on owning and operating our automobiles and driving them around. So a major impact on our quality of life is the financial impact. Next one. Part of the issue that I face as being on the Metro Council, trying to figure out how do you make the transportation system work. So we haven't had a gas tax increase in Oregon since 1992. And with inflation, the amount of concrete you can buy or maintenance you can do or light rail you can build has really dropped. Actually, you can't build light rail with gas taxes, but the same impact is we've seen a big drop in finances for that. Next one, another thing that discourages people in terms of being able to provide transportation and also making shift to other modes or other sources of fuel is our gas, auto ownership rates are about the lowest cost in the country, or our taxes on that. Next one. So we are doing the next step, which I mentioned earlier, and I do have a flyer I'd like to hand out to people that goes into details on how you can participate in the issues that we're trying to deal with, is we're launching what we call a new look. We're looking at this 50-year plan again. We're trying to update that. We're also updating our regional transportation plan to say, with these new issues and challenges coming along, how do we deal with that in a resource-limited world, in a place where we want to protect our quality of life, the farmland, and our health in our communities? How do we do this? So this is a public opportunity for the public to participate in these kind of questions, and we want to make sure that we can meet these challenges so that people, we deal this with equity, and we do it sustainably, and we do it in a way that leaves our environment clean and in good condition. So that's kind of that big, broad overview. And I'm a bicycle rider, so I'm prejudiced. I throw that up there as well, that we do need to look at new ways of doing things in order to deal with major issues that are coming up. And I thank you and appreciate your time, and I'll be here as part of the panel to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Rex. Our next speaker is Commissioner Serena Cruz. She's a Multnomah County Commissioner. She has a bachelor's degree from Lewis and Clark, a master's degree from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a law degree from the University of California, Berkeley, Old Hall School of Law. She's been active in numerous transportation and energy committees, including the Bi-State Coordination Committee and the Columbia River Crossing Task Force. She's also been involved in numerous energy projects that Multnomah County has undertaken to reduce their energy consumption and save taxpayer dollars in the process. So please join me in welcoming Commissioner Serena Cruz.
Good afternoon. Come on, you can be a little more awake than that. Good afternoon. I'm really glad to be here to join you today, and I think you're probably wondering to yourself, Multnomah County, that's really not the government that we think of when we think of a big fleet or the government that's vested in economic development or those kinds of things. So I'd like to spend a minute talking to you about why we got involved in biodiesel at Multnomah County, why we think it's really important, and what we've done. At Multnomah County, we're the government that works with people. As our former chair, Bev Stein, used to say, we work with the community's neediest and the community's naughtiest. So we're aging and disability services, adult and juvenile community justice, family support programs, the libraries, and jails. So not really the kinds of things that you think of when you think of this particular issue. But we do have a fleet, and we do run transportation system, and we do run health clinics and public health in this community. And those were, and as any government in this community, we're interested in the economic development and vitality of the community. So those are the kinds of factors that drew us to what could we do as a customer in influencing the demand for biofuels. So back in August 2002, we started a pilot project. It was a, we started using B20 and in all of our diesel vehicles. We found that there were no capital costs required because, obviously, biodiesel can be used, B20 can be used in any vehicle. No engine modifications were required. No change to storage or infrastructure were required. No performance issues were there, and there were no catastrophic equipment losses. So we've continued this thing that started out as a pilot. And last year, in fiscal year 05, we used 32,176 gallons of biodiesel for all of our fleet vehicles and trucks. And so what have we found in doing that, and why do we think it's important? We think that the use of biodiesel supports our core mission. It reduces impacts to the community and to public health. It does this through a number of different ways. By promoting better air quality, reducing air pollution from traditional diesel. Diesel particulate levels in Portland's air are more than 750 times the health-based safety standard, as found by DEQ's Portland Air Toxics Assessment. And diesel pollution is particularly of concern when we talk about asthma. And I know many of you are probably familiar with the Oregon Environmental Council's study, where they show asthma incidents and its connection to the freeway because of all the particulates and those kinds of things that are affecting the neighborhoods that are aligned along the freeway. And again, as the public health entity for this community, that's something that worries us greatly at the county. The state of Oregon estimates that the public health costs of diesel exhaust pollution are approximately $2 per gallon of diesel used. But we also like biodiesel because it's a renewable domestic fuel product that promotes economic development and turns agricultural waste material into a needed commodity. It kind of hits all of these different chords for us as policymakers, things that we want to be committed to and invested in. And when we change our government's fuel sourcing to biodiesel, we can use our buying policies as leverage to support these kinds of policies more broadly. So what are we looking to do in the future? The next step that we'd like to take is to purchase ultra-low sulfur diesel before the federal mandate in mid-2006. We'll continue to use biodiesel for 20% of fuel and ultra-low sulfur diesel for the other 80%. And we found that actually, and I guess it's known broadly, that biodiesel helps to improve the performance of ultra-low sulfur diesel. The sustainable procurement strategy for 2006, that's how we go about purchasing things in the community, will look for opportunities to work with contractors to utilize biofuels in their contract work with Multnomah County and the City of Portland. And that's part of the Sustainable Development Commission. And Peter's wife is actually, was she still on it? She was on it. One of those great citizens who stepped up to serve our community, to think about the ways that we can change our efforts locally. But that procurement strategy is really going to be looking in City of Portland and in Multnomah County for all the different ways that not just we can use it internally, but how can we use our buying power to say we will give preference to those folks who can figure out how they can use biodiesels and biofuels when they're doing the work for us. Again, just trying to think about leveraging all those different opportunities that we can. And finally, we want to support economic development opportunities in Oregon for biofuels, for the manufacture, which is beginning right here in my district, very proud of that fact, market expansion, and for pilot projects. We think that using biodiesel is our way of walking the talk and helping to support this new market model. And we really are excited about the multiple level of benefits that we're able to connect with the farming community and bring in that demand for those that market, as well as the waste fuels that we've got in town. It's kind of hard to imagine that this isn't something that everyone is getting excited about. And so we really supported the legislation that State Representative Jackie Dingfelder tried to pass in this last session. And what my colleagues agreed to do is we supported a resolution in support of Jackie's legislation, because we can't pass that legislation, but we can show the legislators in Salem that we think there are multiple levels of benefits, that we've incorporated this use of this fuel into our efforts, and obviously trying to connect it beyond our direct efforts. And so if we could do it at the state level, it makes all of our efforts that much easier, because if you can broaden the base of the demand, you'll bring down the price and make it even easier to access. I'm actually very interested in biodiesel because I'm a biofuel user myself. I've been using biodiesel in my vehicle for over a couple years now. And I really think that it's one of the important decisions that I can make individually as a consumer. And so I can see how important it is if we can do that as a government and begin to take that work a little more broadly. For those times when we have to drive, or we choose to drive and we're going to be working on reducing our efforts to drive, as Rex would like us always to be thinking about. But that's pretty much what we're doing at Multnomah County, and I'm sure Jackie's going to give you a whole lot more at the state. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Our next speaker is Katie Fast. Katie is Associate Director of the Oregon Farm Bureau, and in that role, she's an advocate of agricultural interests before the legislature and government agencies. Katie is widely regarded for her skilled advocacy and effective diplomacy. She graduated from Oregon State University in Animal Sciences and grew up and worked on a family farm. Please join me in welcoming Katie Fast.
Thank you. Glad to see you all here today. The agriculture community of Oregon is excited about the growing use of biofuels, not just because we think we have the potential in the future to grow the crops for it, but also we're a high energy user. We use it in our production. We use it for the commodities that we purchase to put into our crop production, and then also for transporting our crops across the nation and across the world. With that, I think it's maybe an optimistic, cautious piece that we have, a mixture of the two. And part of that is because of uncertainty with technology as it's increasing. I think we're going to see more technologies coming for the agriculture community to make it more cost efficient. And also the prices that we're seeing for a lot of the crops right now don't fit into a lot of Oregon's business models. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. In Oregon right now, we produce over 200 different agricultural commodities. So biofuels and the production of the crops for biofuels will be one of the pieces of our diversity that we're already flourishing in and very good at. For right now, on the short term, I think we're going to see the biodiesel industry grow in Oregon first before ethanol. As far as agricultural production. Canola is the crop right now that we're hearing a lot of talk of, and I know you heard more in the previous panel about canola production. The price is the biggest challenge right now on that. When you're looking at 9 to 10 cents, it doesn't compete well with a lot of our other agricultural crops, especially here in the Willamette Valley. We'll probably see more conversion in Eastern Oregon from some wheat land and using canola there for production where they have lower land prices. One farm will have a larger land mass. They're dealing more in volume than in small land bases, high value crops. With that, it's one of these chickens versus the egg, which comes first. And for our producers to start growing these products, the market needs to bring the facilities here as well. And co-op opportunities where farmers can come together and put in a co-op to produce the fuel, to market the fuel, is probably where we have a lot of potential. And the farmer also will get income from his crop, and he'll get income from that collective base and marketing of the fuel. For ethanol production, the potential there, we probably have more in the cellulosic production than with the conversion of corn and other crops to ethanol. And that's because just with land prices and production processes, the Midwest is probably always going to be able to outcompete us price-wise for the production of corn than we can produce it here in Oregon. And we're seeing that with the facilities going in, the ethanol facilities going in here in the Northwest. They can ship corn via rail cheaper to Oregon than they can purchase it from Oregon farmers. So we don't see a lot of potential in that market. But the cellulosic, as technology improves and the price of the enzymes that are used to convert straw and wood waste to ethanol, as that becomes more affordable, we have a huge potential in Oregon. We're a major grass seed production state, and there's the straw waste. As we're not burning fields as much now, we're baling that straw and marketing it globally. Well, that global price is dropping, so we're looking for other opportunities to market our straw, and ethanol can be one in the future. Along with that, we produce wheat in eastern Oregon. There's a straw base there, and then also forest thinnings as well. We saw some changes policy-wise nationally that's going to help the agriculture community, we believe, with a national energy policy. And that was with the passage of H.R. 6, the new energy bill that had broad bipartisan support. And that's what we're seeing is conservatives and liberals both can come together and support renewable energy. And we saw that with, and Jackie Dingfelder is going to talk more about the state legislation that we had that wasn't successful, but it had both aisles supporting it strongly. But in the federal energy policy, it set a renewable fuel standard at 7.5 billion gallons for ethanol and biodiesel both. And that will be potential coming from agricultural crops nationwide. Along with it, there was the extension of biodiesel tax credits for two additional years till 2008. The agriculture industry would probably like to see those extended for more of a 10-year block because it works better in a business plan as you're setting up some of these markets. There was also modification and improvements made to the small producer tax credits as well. We're still faced with challenges, though. As I said, price is a big challenge, but there are producers in Oregon looking to put in crushing facilities or conversion facilities on the farm, co-ops looking at starting to produce this in Pendleton and other places of the state. But with it, if this is a new industry that you're starting to jump into, there's a lot of governmental incentives out there for people. However, the challenges that our members are facing is where do you start? Who do you talk to first? What are the processes for applying for these grants? Where can you get assistance? And a lot of times the answer is five different agencies. And so there's going to need to be some policy changes and some assistance to streamline these processes so the agriculture community can really become a leader and figure out what it's going to make make it profitable for the farm to become a producer and a marketer of the fuel. So these changes are going to bring about by the innovators that are starting this process now. And we have farmers in Klamath Falls and in Pendleton and here in the Willamette Valley who are starting to look at investing on the farm into fuel conversion facilities. And I think they're really going to be the ones that lead the industry and set up the template that others can follow along. And I'll be here later to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Katie. Our next speaker is Peter Murchie. Peter is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Region 10 diesel team leader and co-lead for the EPA West Coast Diesel Collaborative. In his 10 years with EPA, the last four in Portland, he has worked on mobile source regulations, ecosystem management planning, and community air toxics. He has a master's degree of science in natural resource management and a master's of public health from the University of Michigan. Please join me in welcoming Peter Murchie.
Thanks, Mike. And I just want to start off by saying I'm very happy to be here on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency and some of our sister agencies to talk a little bit about what we're trying to do to support and facilitate the leadership that's already being shown by folks that are up here on the stage, for most of you probably out there, and trying to do the right thing in within your lives and the construct of what you can do around using cleaner fuels, driving less, or whatever it may be. So just want to start off with that, and we'll be flipping through. I'm going to focus a little bit about, you know, why is this an issue for us from an environmental health standpoint? What is it about diesel emissions that make it something that we want to have less of them for? And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the West Coast Collaborative and what we're doing as federal partnerships. And lastly, talk a little bit about some of the projects that are out there, and hopefully we can do that pretty quickly. Next slide. So diesel exhaust has a variety of particulars about it that make it pretty nasty. It can exacerbate asthma, respiratory, and cardiac disease. It's a possible human carcinogen, and the states of Washington, Oregon, and California have prioritized diesel emission reductions because of this issue, and estimate that 70 to upwards of 90% of the cancer risk from air toxics is from diesel emissions. It also degrades air quality from an ozone and particulate matter standpoint. Rex talked about Portland being an attainment for the particulate matter and for ozone national ambient air quality standards, but he also outlined some of the issues around growth. And, you know, as you grow, unless you're doing something to mitigate that, the emissions related to that growth, it's possible that you know, the areas like Portland and Seattle that are in attainment and are in maintenance could push that boundary of not being having those air quality days stay clear. So it does us a service to continue to try to strive to reduce our emissions. And then lastly, as was talked about, climate change is another issue, and I won't touch on that too much today. Okay? We also have some issues with susceptible populations, and I'll just talk about the elderly, those that are already immunosuppressed or already have diseases that they're dealing with, are going to be the first ones to get hit by this. Children especially, they're more likely to be active out of doors. Their bodies are still developing, and they breathe more per body pound than we do. And if you've noticed, there's a lot of schools and daycare centers that are located on major thoroughfares near highways. It's definitely a concern that we have, and we want to do more with school buses and things like that to improve the environment for our children. Okay. This is just an example of what we're talking about here. So the picture on the left is a hair follicle, and the picture on the right is the size of PM10, or PM with 10 microns, and then PM2.5, which is a finer particulate matter. And you can see from that, you know, we're really talking about very small particles. And the reason I bring this up is that we have defense mechanisms in our body that, you know, mucus and other things that trap most of the large-sized particles, and we get rid of them. But the smaller they get, the farther they go into our lungs, the more opportunity for metals and toxins and other things to attach to them and get in there and cause those respiratory and cardiac problems. Okay? So we have a two-pronged strategy, basically. We have regulatory approach, which many of you may know about, where we write rules for cars and trucks and tractors and things like that, making the engines cleaner. We also write rules for fuels. And then the other part that I'm going to talk about later is our voluntary approaches to try to help facilitate innovation and demonstration of new technologies. We've been very busy in the past 5 years writing rules for heavy-duty diesel engines. We have the Clean Diesel Truck and Bus Rule, which will be coming into place very quickly. And then we have the Cleaner Non-Road Diesel Rule. One component that I mentioned is the fuels, and it was talked about before, ultra-low sulfur diesel, basically taking the sulfur out of diesel, which will reduce the amount of particles that come out, makes it possible for us to use retrofits and other technologies, will be required in next year, in 2006, for all on-highway applications. And then in 2007, we're also going to have low sulfur diesel, which is a little bit more diesel, but much less than we have now, for the non-road engines, the construction equipment, ag equipment, things like that. And then in 2010, those non-road engine applications, construction, will also have to use ultra-low sulfur diesel. And then in 2012, for locomotives and marine, we're kind of staging it in. And then we have some early adopters. I know in Oregon, we have folks that are using ultra-low sulfur diesel down in Lane. Washington State has been using ultra-low sulfur diesel for quite a while in the Puget Sound area, and it's been very helpful for us to have that leadership to show that these fuels are usable and can be used in regular application. Okay? So what are we doing with the engine standards? Basically, we're going to be requiring that new engines manufactured here and sold here have to be much, much cleaner than the old engines were. Now, there's a qualification there. We don't have the authority to regulate the existing diesel fleet. Congress didn't give that to us, so our rules will only apply to those new engines that are sold. That means that there's about 11 million heavy-duty diesel engines out there that are still relatively dirty, and as many of you know, they last a very long time. They're built to last a long time. So we're looking at 10, 20, 30, maybe even more than 30 years of use from some of these dirtier diesel engines, and we want to do something about those. Okay? We're going to get quite a bit of benefit from this, but we won't see that full benefit until 2030 because of that fleet turnover. But it's significant. You know, reducing particulate matter, the toxins that are spewed out, will save us on health care costs. 12,000 premature deaths will be avoided yearly because of these rules when they're fully implemented. And we'll save about $150 billion from these rules. But again, that full savings won't get to us until 2030 when we have most of the engines under the rule. So what do we do with those 11 million engines that are in place right now? Well, we've tried to utilize voluntary programs. We targeted children first, one of our more susceptible populations, with the Clean School Bus USA program. And I know our friends in Washington State have enacted or put into place a program where they're going to retrofit all of their school buses in the next couple of years. I think there's a lot of activity in Oregon as well through some innovative programs to use cleaner fuels and retrofits in school buses here in the state as well. And we also have the Smartway Transport Partnership that wasn't really touched on, but doing idle reduction, more aerodynamic trucks, looking at better ways of moving freight, so we have more efficiencies in the ports, things like that, can get significant reductions as well. And then we have a voluntary retrofit and replacement program. All of this is housed under the National Clean Diesel Campaign. So we can do more, and we think we can do a lot more on the West Coast. We already have the leadership. We have real progressive policies at the state and local level, some regional collaboration all set up. So what are we doing as EPA? Well, we convene the West Coast Collaborative with the request of many of our partners at the state and local level saying, look, we're doing a lot of things locally, but we have a lot of regional drivers. We have ports that are in competition. We have I-5 corridor. We have trucking and rail routes. We have ag that agriculture that's similar across the West Coast. EPA, how can you help us with funding? How can you help us with technology transfer to do even more? And so that's what we've been up to. We have five sector work groups, marine vessels and ports, trucking, locomotive, agriculture, and construction and distributed generation, those stationary generators. And we also have a sixth category, which is in a formal work group, but in all of these, cleaner fuels, especially biofuels and renewables, are a major component of what folks are trying to work on. So what have we had as successes so far? Well, we've been able to give out about $3 million total over the past 2 years without a federal budget, a specific federal budget for it. We've been cobbling it together because this has been a priority for our two regions on the West Coast. We've leveraged quite a bit of resources, and much of that is in Oregon with some very innovative programs that Mike runs in the Department of Energy around tax credits and low-interest loans. We also have an entity in Oregon that's set up by state law called the Climate Trust, which looks towards getting carbon reductions. They're very interested in idle reduction. We're working on auxiliary power units in to allow truckers to not run their main engines when they're idling, things like that. And we also have some things that are strong potential. There was a lot of activity at the federal level. I think you're going to hear a little bit about the state next. But at the federal level, there was a strong interest in authorizing even more resources being made available for diesel mitigation. And specifically, there's almost $500 million a year for 5 years in the Energy Act, the new Energy Act, for voluntary diesel projects, both on the fuel and engine side. The problem is it wasn't appropriated. So EPA is authorized to spend it, but we weren't appropriated to have it. But I think it's a real step forward, and I think there's a lot of activity right now to try to get more support for those monies. Okay? So how does biodiesel play for us in this? Why are we interested in it? What are the roles and benefits of using biofuels? Well, it's part of a systems approach. I've talked a little bit about engines and fuels. But we think there's cleaner technologies, obviously, that can be used. There's improved behaviors, such as idle reduction and better freight transportation. And then biodiesel is one of the components. Besides ultra-low sulfur diesel, there's also emulsified diesel. They can get you reduction benefits. The nice thing about biodiesel that I'm sure you know or heard about already is it's lower in emissions. It's safer fuel handling. It's much less toxic if you spill it. It's compatibility. You talked a little bit about McIntosh being the biodiesel. Actually, I think biodiesel is like the freeware solution. I think it's really compatible with the engine types that we have out there right now. and it's domestically produced and has been talked about, energy security, economic development in our rural areas, real strong potential with biofuels. Okay? This comes from a report we did in 2002 looking at biodiesel specifically, and you can see that this chart on the x-axis, you have 0% biodiesel in the fuel up to a B100 or 100% blend. And you can see that you get significant reductions in particulate matter and carbon monoxide and hydrocarbons the more you increase the use of or the blend of biodiesel. But you also get a slight increase in nitrogen oxides, and that's an issue not so much up here, but it's definitely an issue in places like California where they have a smog problem, and nitrogen oxides are a contributor to smog. This is just the same type of information but laid out by B20 and B100, and you can see that even with B20, you get significant reductions just from using that fuel. So two of the pollutants of most concern is PM. You get a 6% reduction with B20 and almost 20% for the hydrocarbons. So what have we been doing as part of the collaborative to support cleaner fuels projects? Well, last year we gave out some money to the Blue and Gold Fleet in San Francisco, if you've ever been a tourist down there, and where they're using emulsified fuel, which is showing real promise. It's not a renewable fuel, but it definitely gets reductions. We just announced a Bio 49 Degrees project that we're really excited about. It's a partnership with the Northwest Technology Center and two community colleges, one on the Canadian side, one on the U.S. side, to use biorefineries in the schools and do a training program for folks to get a degree, not a degree, but a certification in being able to make biodiesel. And then they're going to use that from vegetable oil and use that in Puget Sound Energy's utility trucks along the border. And they're going to be testing out a couple of those trucks in B100, but most will be run on B20 with ultra-low sulfur diesel. It's going to displace about 144,000 gallons of petroleum diesel, which I think is a real significant project. And then we have, in San Joaquin Valley, we've been funding an ag-related project where we're using additives to biodiesel to try to reduce the NOx emissions, which is very important, again, for California. And we've been working with the National Park Service in using fish oil. There's a lot of fish oil in the processing facilities there, and they've been using B100 made from fish oil in their stationary generators in Denali National Park, and it's been very successful. And then Washington State Ferries, as was mentioned in the last panel, has been using and testing B20 in the marine environment. So if you have any other questions, we have a website that's very informative, and next week we're actually going to be launching our cleaner fuels website as a portion of this, and I welcome your questions and the discussion later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Our final speaker is Representative Jackie Dingfelder. She's been a state legislator since 2000. Representing portions of Portland. She graduated with a bachelor's degree from UCLA in ecosystems, received a master's in regional planning from the University of North Carolina. In the legislature, she's been a strong advocate on energy and environmental issues. And this past session, she was one of the two principal co-sponsors of the comprehensive set of biofuels legislation that you've heard a lot about today. In addition, she sponsored and successfully passed overwhelmingly through the legislature House Bill 3363. And that bill gives Oregon some of the most strongest energy and water efficient standards for commercial appliances and electrical equipment in the country. So it's a real pleasure for me to introduce and ask you to welcome Representative Jackie Dingfelder.
Thank you. I'm a little vertically challenged here, so I have to bring this down. Again, thanks for being here on this Sunday afternoon. My name is Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and I've worked very closely with Mike Rainey. We're very fortunate to have Mike heading up our Department of Energy because I couldn't have gotten the legislation through that he just mentioned without his help. And that was one of the few pieces of proactive environmental legislation that we actually got through. So I was really pleased to work with him on that. But I'm going to
the finalist on this panel by sort of saying what can we do at the state level. And I do want to point out that it's pretty rare to have almost every level of government. I was thinking about that. We have the U.S. EPA, the federal regulators and folks who write rules and set standards. Obviously, I represent the state. We have the regional planning agency, or Metro, who helps set policies for transportation. And then you heard Commissioner Serena Cruz talk about what she's been doing with the county. And I have also been working with our city commissioners to look at doing something similar at the city level to provide incentives to use diesel in their heavy equipment. They're already doing it for some of their agencies, but not all of them. So it's pretty rare that you have this level of collaboration, but it just shows that this is an important enough issue that every level of government here in Oregon has said we need to work together on this. And hopefully my colleagues in the legislature will realize that as well, and we'll be able to get through some legislation next time. I'm going to talk a little bit about the package of bills that I worked on last session and my hopes for next session. And you probably heard that I have co-sponsored a package of bills with put it this way, we were called the Odd Couple of Oregon, and the co-sponsor of the package was a rather conservative rural legislator. I happen to be a liberal Democrat. He was a conservative Republican, so that drew a lot of attention in the legislature. But it just goes to show that you don't have to be a certain type of person or come from a certain area in the state or a certain background to support renewable energy. It makes sense whether you're conservative or liberal or urban or rural or a farmer or urbanite. It makes sense for Oregon. And that was one of the reasons that I was very excited to be a co-sponsor of that package. And the way that we promoted this package, and you've already heard many of these themes here today, that I would say the benefits were wide-ranging for Oregonians. And basically, through the series of bills that we had proposed, we were hoping to increase our energy security, and that means not relying solely on non-renewable fuels, but to try to incent and grow the market for renewable fuels. Also promote economic development, because although, as you've probably read, our unemployment numbers are going down and have gone down significantly, that's not for all areas of the state. And rural areas are still hurting, as certain areas in urban places around the state. So this is, I think, another great opportunity for economic development. I actually look at the whole renewable fuels industry as sort of the next wave of higher-paying, innovative jobs, just like high technology was, 10, 15 years ago here in Oregon. And so I think there's great potential there. And then finally, environmental stewardship. And all three of those messages really resonated well with my colleagues. And I will say that we had an even number of Republicans and Democrats that co-sponsored the bills. So what was this package of legislation? Some of you may have read about it. We had many hearings. I'm just going to briefly go over it, give you a little bit of background on it, and then sort of say what my hopes are for next session. The bills that I co-sponsored, they were written to attempt to sort of promote six main goals. The first one was to provide incentive to produce biofuels actually in Oregon, because we don't produce a lot of biofuels here. And this bill would have expanded, actually, this is the one thing, right, because this did pass. This is the one piece of legislation that did pass. And so it's very exciting, because this actually may help, and we already have actually a facility that's going online here to start producing more biofuels at a larger scale, and that was to expand a property tax exemption for biodiesel production facilities. And what happened is we already had a property tax exemption on the books for ethanol facilities, but we wanted to expand that property tax exemption for biodiesel production facilities. So that actually did pass at the very last minutes of the legislative session. And this will allow biodiesel production plants to take advantage of this property tax exemption. So it gives them a jump start
when they want to produce biodiesel here in Oregon. So the rest of these didn't pass, but I thought I'd tell you about them anyway because I thought they were good ideas, and hopefully we'll be able to bring them back whether they're going to be in the exact same form or not. But one was to provide incentives to utilize Oregon crops as a feedstock for biofuels. And you've already heard that from Katie that a lot of the feedstocks are coming from either outside the state or outside the country. Canada actually offers a very inexpensive feedstock, canola, and we had this idea to help provide incentives for farmers here within the state that want to grow crops as a feedstock. So that was one of the ideas. Another was to provide tax incentives or tax credits for farmers through an existing, it's called a pollution control tax credit. So they would have been eligible to use that on some of their equipment. That didn't pass. We'll probably reexamine that and see if we can bring that back next time. The one that I guess I was most excited about that unfortunately didn't pass, and that would have set a renewable fuel standard for all ethanol and diesel that's used in the state. Let me explain a little bit how that would have worked. This would have required a minimum blend of renewable fuel in gasoline and diesel sold in the state. So by 2010, all of our gasoline would have had to have 10% ethanol. And then by 2006, all of our gasoline or all of our diesel gasoline would have had to have 2% biodiesel, and that would have risen to 5% by 2010. Now, why does the state want to tell, you know, private dealers and blenders what to do with their fuel? And part of that is to provide a jump start for the market. And you heard Katie talk about, is it the chicken or the egg? Do we produce the fuel or do we drive the market and try to jump start the market? The idea was here, if there was a more of a market for this, then hopefully it would mean farmers would want to go grow crops. We'd have production facilities here because people who produce biofuel, they want to know that there's a steady market for their product. So that was the whole idea. If producers knew that Oregon was going to be selling either ethanol in the gasoline or more biodiesel in our diesel fuel, then that would have provided a great of incentive for production here in the state. And then the fourth element was expanding markets for biofuels and doing that the way the county's doing it currently, saying we're going to use a certain percentage in all of our county heavy equipment. And we have the idea to do that at the state level. And so that, again, expands the market for biofuels. So the fourth element of this package would have required state government. So as a legislative body, we would say to all of our agencies, you're going to have to use a certain percentage of biodiesel in your heavy equipment because it's mainly heavy equipment. And so we said that all of the state agencies had to displace with biodiesel at least 5% of the total amount of diesel that we consume in diesel engines. That's across all state agencies. And then another incentive would have reduced the fuel tax on biodiesel purchased for use in lightweight vehicles. So that, again, provides another incentive for farmers or anyone using diesel, actually people who drive diesel cars. It would have provided an incentive to buy biodiesel. And then another incentive that we had proposed was waiving the use fuel tax on farm vehicles that are burning 100% biodiesel. Again, another incentive to use a non-renewable alternative. Now, right now, things have changed a little bit in that, as you know, gasoline and diesel prices have gone up a lot. And so that is actually going to provide another incentive that, you know, we didn't anticipate would happen so quickly because biodiesel traditionally has been more expensive than regular diesel. But with the price of regular diesel coming up, it's actually providing almost a level playing field. So I'm actually not unhappy about that because it will help boost the market. Just the price of diesel itself will help us say, you know, let's look at biodiesel because it's actually now competitive with regular diesel.
It doesn't mean that we don't want to look at expanding these markets in the future, but that has helped on its own. And then finally, you heard from the representative from the Environmental Protection Agency that diesel fumes are a big concern for health impacts on our children. And the final element of this package would have created a clean diesel bus program here in Oregon. And we would have increased the pump licensing fees, so that's not something that you pay, but actually the dealers pay, to fund school districts to retrofit their old diesel buses with cleaner engines and cleaner fuel. And that is happening to a small extent. You heard that actually it was in the energy bill that there was money put aside. Is that correct, energy bill? Put aside for this fund, but I think it's $10 million over 50 states. So we'll be lucky if we get some of that money. Hopefully we will, to achieve those purposes. So that was the whole package that was proposed that had bipartisan support. I'm not going to go into the details of why it didn't pass. I mean, I'll just tell you one word, politics. That's why it didn't pass. It wasn't the merits of the bill. It wasn't that there wasn't bipartisan support. It wasn't that there wasn't support from the business community. It was politics. And unfortunately, I think it really hurt us all because, as you probably know, the Oregon legislature only meets every other year. So that means that we won't have an opportunity to go back and revisit these policies until 2007. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be sitting by idle. I'm actually talking to folks at this conference about what we should be doing next. Are these bills still valid? Should we look at a different approach? And I'd be very, if you're interested in these ideas, I'd be very interested to hear from you, and you can look on my website or email me. It's rep.jackiedingfelder@stateoforegon.state.or.us or Google Jackie Dingfelder. There's not too many of us. Because we really need to hear from you if this is the type of policies that you want to see passed by your state legislators. I got a lot of positive feedback from my constituents and people I work through throughout the state, urban, rural, Democrats, Republicans. Again, I think that people want to see policies that will help both the urban areas and the rural areas, especially with economic development. So the way I'm going to be looking at this is what can we do to make changes in this package that we can go back and try to get support next time. But we really need help from folks like you to put pressure on elected officials to say, you know, this is important. We need a non-renewable fuels policy for the state of Oregon. It's great that the county's doing it, and we're fortunate to have leadership at both the metro and the county level with other elected officials that are willing to step forward and make sure that that happens at the local level. But I think it's only fair that communities across our state have those opportunities as well. So I'm going to be working hard over the next year with many of the folks here at this conference to see if we can come up with something to once again have Oregon as a leader on the environment and energy. I mean, it's been 30 years since the bottle bill passed, many other great things that we've done. However, I think that Oregon should step up and can step up and show some leadership on energy security, economic development, and environmental stewardship. So thanks so much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Representative. Now's a chance for you to ask questions, and if there's a particular panelist you'd like to address your question to, please indicate that. Andrea here has a microphone you can use, so we'll all be able to hear you well. Any questions or comments you'd like to make? Or are we going to get off easy because we're the last panel of the day?
There's one in the back.
There's one.
Hi. Thanks for having this exposition here. I'm new to Oregon, but I'm not new to biodiesel. I worked for Providence Elder Place, and I got them to use biodiesel in one of the buses that I drove, and it made a huge difference. So I'm well aware of the health benefits, because I worked with regular diesel for years, and I know that it's linked to a lot of organ cancers and stuff. So I'm curious why TriMet's not involved in this exposition, and maybe I missed something about, are they here? No. about the engines and why their engines can't be converted or why biodiesel can't be used in the TriMet buses. I mean, isn't it a supply and demand? I mean, if you see ads in Willamette Week on how to build your own little biodiesel pump, you know, or a still, if we can do it as individuals, I would think that some of the money coming through TriMet, that they could create a place to make biodiesel and then start using it.
That's an excellent question, and the reason I jumped up, and I do not represent TriMet, or I'm not the spokesperson for TriMet, so I'd want to be clear, but I have been working with TriMet on this issue because they actually have a presence at the state legislature, and they were very supportive of the state policies. They're looking, they're going to do a trial with their buses and some of their equipment. And they're actually planning a big press conference next month that they've invited me to be at. But I can't tell you all the specifics because they're still working it out. But it is to displace a certain percentage of their fuel with biodiesel. Now, one of the things that would help is for them to hear, if you're a TriMet customer, which I am, I took Max over here, but if you're a TriMet customer, I would highly encourage you to email or write them Fred Hansen, who's the director, and say, we really support that you're doing this, but we'd like to see it more. I think one of the issues for them is cost, and they're weighing the increase in cost because it still does cost more to use biodiesel with the fact that they just had a recent fare increase and that they're trying to balance that. So that's all that I know. I certainly am going to continue to work with them, but we all need to support the fact that they are looking at using biodiesel and try to get them to use more over time. So stay tuned because I know that they're coming out with something next month. But that was an excellent question.
Thank you. For Katie Fast, can you give me any kind of an idea of what the difference between producing the feedstock for the oil is as compared to what any kind of regular present stock is?
Well, I think your question is the difference between producing biodiesel or feedstock for fuel compared to normal agriculture that we're producing now. You know, it really depends on the operation, but for here in the Willamette Valley, it's a huge profit margin difference. When you're looking at, you know, the crop, like grass seed right now, the price is around $22-$23 for annual ryegrass cents per pound compared to canola, which is, you know, we've heard earlier, 9 to 10 cents per pound. I mean, then you have to look at conversion rates and so forth, but the inputs are going to be about the same. Some other differences, though, are we are looking in the agriculture industry on these field crops like grass seed and wheat, a rotation crop that we can bring in so we're not producing wheat on top of wheat on top of wheat. And so there is a benefit for growing a different type of crop, like canola or some other oilseed crop. There's benefits that you get with the soil, with reduced costs on input. You can reduce your cost of pesticides and fertilizers and other things that you're going to put into the soil if you can put in a rotation crop. But right now, we're going to need to see increases in prices. I think it gets a little more profitable from talking to people when we're looking at, you know, about 12 cents. However, University of Idaho, University of Montana, Oregon State University are doing research on different varieties. Right now, I would say practically a farmer's going to get 18 pounds per the acre for canola. But there are varieties out there that we're hearing about that can get 4,000 pounds per acre. And if we can produce that here, it really makes it more economical, and that's where people get excited. So, you know, it's an industry that people are talking about a lot, and it's just going to take time and investment. Something I also didn't talk about was the 2007 Farm Bill, which really drives a lot of the national agricultural policy, has an energy title in it. And something that we're going to be advocating for is increased research in biofuels and also low funding grants for farmers and so forth. So, I mean, there's potential, but, you know, the prices vary on operation.
We have a question here as well.
This is to State Representative. I'm wondering about the percentages of biofuel that are going to be required in, respectively, or ethanol that will be required in fuels if indeed your bill would pass. They seem pretty low to me. Are they in response to what's available for production, or are they just in response to, you know, not irritating the petroleum interests?
It's actually more related to production, and we will be revisiting those percentages since things are changing so quickly in the industry. But actually, we didn't want to set the standard too high and set us up for failure because then, well, if you require certain percentages, it's just not available, then, you know, people are going to throw up their hands and say, well, we can't meet this. This is unrealistic. So part of it is that. I will tell you the petroleum industry wasn't exactly thrilled with the bills. I mean, that's another reason it didn't pass. And, again, you know, we need to put pressure on our, you know, suppliers, on other elected officials and say, you know, this is a renewable option. I mean, the way I look at it is energy security. And I think people are getting the message more. I mean, things have changed a lot since we got out of session in August. You had Hurricane Katrina, the increase in gas prices, the reduction in availability. People, I think, are getting it more and more, the volatility of our facilities here. I mean, we had one event that wiped out a whole series of refineries. And so being heavily dependent on one source of fuel, if anything, it could help displace and provide, you know, an alternative if we have more natural catastrophes like that or we can't get fuel from other sources. So I certainly think we should revisit it based on availability. So that's what we proposed last time. It doesn't mean that's what will be proposed next time. And we're going to also be looking at what other states propose. And obviously, the petroleum industry is having to respond to that as well. The only other state right now, I think, is Minnesota, correct, that has a renewable fuel standard that passed. But Washington's looking at one, and I'm sure there's going to be other states over the next year, so I'll be following that very heavily. I think it could be definitely a reality. I mean, it depends on a couple of things. One, if California's in a certain – it's an interesting situation with California because of their clean car emission standards, and we can have the EPA person talk about that because that's a whole another situation in California. I mean, the reality is California is the driver for the market. It's like 20% of the national market. And so, you know, we're peanuts compared to California. And certainly I have this vision as well that the West Coast could be a leader. You know, Oregon and Washington combined can certainly help offset and impact the market. But California itself is really the driver. But there is no reason why we can't be displacing at least a certain percentage of all of our diesel with biodiesel. And you've heard, I mean, you don't have to buy a special engine. Doesn't impact the engine. There's really no reason except for making sure that we have a steady supply and that it's blended properly and many of the things that you've heard here already at the conference. So I don't know if you want to mention at all how it interacts with the California rules because I think it is important to hear that.
Well, first, I think there's a lot of potential to have a clean corridor concept be successful from Mexico up into British Columbia, and I think it's something we're working on right now with all the governments up and down the coast, and it's not just cleaner fuels, although that's one component. It's also idle reduction, making sure there's truck stop, electrification along the corridor, auxiliary power units for trucks, cleaner trucks in general. So I think it is possible. I think there's also the Tri-State Governor's Agreement is working on solutions for climate change. I'm sure biofuels is something on the table there for that too. As for California has a special status, mainly because they were a little bit ahead of us in our national rules. Is basically a California car and then the rest of the country. And as you've seen lately, Oregon and Washington have recently made steps to adopt California rules for mobile sources for light-duty vehicles, specifically for under CALEV. It is possible for Washington and Oregon to adopt many of the other mobile source-related rules that California adopts, so they have that ability. It's very difficult for individual states to actually, it's not allowed for them to create their own mobile source emission standards separate from California's or ours. But I think that there's a lot of interest in working regionally around this, and I think there's especially a lot of interest to work on both the production side, trying to maybe look regionally for some solutions on the chicken and egg problem with the agricultural community, working with Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and California together, but also on the use side, on the demand and supply to try to make it feasible there.
Two things, too. We have time for only about two more questions, and these two individuals had designated. But there's also a tour of a local oil refinery company called Orco, and that bus is just about to take off about 4 o'clock. So if you're interested in doing that, that's also in the parking lot as well. And we'll go start with you first, John.
But it seems that you're all involved in really wonderful programs. Oh, sorry. Seems that you're all, involved in really wonderful programs on the policymaking level. What can we as individual citizens do to help help influence policymakers towards the use of more biofuels? And as a separate question, what can we do as consumers to help move towards better availability and more use of biofuels in the future?
I'm a politician, I'll talk about the political side of it. Someone else can talk about the consumer side of it. I think that we can do as much as you ask us to do, to tell the truth. You get elected office and you think, okay, I'm king of the world, but you're not. You work within a partnership of all the different governments. You're limited by your ability to make action happen. And my background is as a grassroots community activist. And I try to maintain that relationship with people who still do that kind of work because it makes my life a lot easier. I can accomplish things if I'm responding as a politician, as an elected official, to the public. And I think it's a mistake if we think, oh, well, we elected some good people, we'll just sit back now. It's really important that you write letters to the editor, that you comment at the appropriate times. For example, Metro operates the solid waste system. We use 1 million gallons of diesel a year to ship our solid waste, your solid waste, out to eastern Oregon. We do use low-sulfur diesel. We've gone into a partnership with TriMet to make sure we can import enough down here through the pipeline from Seattle area, and they had a minimum requirement how much we do. So we went together with TriMet to get lower-sulfur diesel here. Biodiesel is another step forward on that one. This is a new issue to me in many ways, and so it's really great to hear about this stuff and then I'm finding out right now, what are the capacity? Can we get 1 million gallons of biodiesel in this region? Well, now that's a new question because I was invited here to participate by you with the fire in your hair, Andrea. You know, you invited me here to come, and I've learned something. But it's important that you maintain your role as a citizen, and I'm going to do one more advertisement for my piece of paper I'm going to run to the door and hand out as this ends today, to participate, talk about the issues you care about, get them in the newspaper, you know, just through letters to editor and those types of things are really helpful for us. It raises the issues up. And it makes it easier for us as elected officials to say, you know, this is an issue that the people want us to deal with. So that's very helpful. I can't answer the consumer side.
We do have. Do you want to do Sprinter? But you want
let me address the consumer side because I think you can do the same thing with corporations. You can influence them. The biodiesel legislation, the biofuels legislation that didn't pass was largely because the automobile manufacturers opposed it. We don't have any automobile manufacturers in Oregon, and you know they shouldn't have had that impact, and they shouldn't. And it shouldn't matter to them. They'll make money on fuel-efficient cars. They'll make money on cars that run on biodiesel and run on ethanol just as much as they make money on gasoline. But it's going to cost them some money to convert, and they're used to doing things the way they're used to doing things. If they hear from you, both directly and through your choices, that you're not going to take SUVs that just are very fuel inefficient. It doesn't mean you don't have to have SUVs, but you have SUVs that are efficient or are hybrids or can run on biodiesel. Same with other types of cars. And there are manufacturers who are making some of those. That's how you can impact them. So it's going to cost them more not to change than it is to change. Then you can have impacts on them.
We had one last final question.
I think it was either Serena or Peter that said something about $2 of medical expense per gallon of diesel used. And then I heard Jackie speak about TriMet's concern about the added expense of biodiesel. We know that in part we are fighting a war for more access to energies. And I'm wondering what can be done by me or us on the level of either education or legislation to help people understand the real costs involved and or to change the way we're pricing these products so that they reflect the real costs.
I'll take a stab. First, nobody wants to support higher prices on anything, unfortunately. So that's a drawback, but you're absolutely right. And if we priced oil at the real cost, including the cost of sending our military overseas to protect supply lines and to do the other things with why they're in Iraq versus other countries, the price of oil would be and the price of gasoline would be much higher than it is now. It is much higher, but it's just being paid for out of a different budget. So biodiesel and ethanol, it's hard for them to compete. Petroleum has had subsidies, billions of dollars of subsidies for decades for its exploration, for its development. Same with coal and natural gas. And what we want is to level the playing field somewhat. We're not asking for the huge amount of subsidies that they received in the past, but we think it's important that renewable energy generally and biodiesel and ethanol in particular get a reasonable amount of incentives from the federal government and support so that they can have an impact. So we don't have our foreign policy driven by the need to drive our own cars.
I'd like to add kind of plays on both questions. There's a lot of organizations out there that represent different interests for different reasons. That are excited about biofuels. And I would just encourage people to get connected with one of those organizations. One that we deal with is Harvesting Clean Energy Network. They have a website that you can go to and get signed up on, emails that come out, so you can stay informed on what's going on in the region on biofuels. During the legislation period, there were emails that you could get hooked up through that would let you know, what was going on with the legislation when you needed to contact legislators. So there's a lot of different organizations out there that you can hook up with that'll give you information and help you with that process of contacting legislators or educating different people and inform you about conferences like this as well.
I want to thank you all for coming today, and there's a few other individuals that I wanted to thank. Again, I wanted to thank all of our speakers, and that's Mitchell Hartman, Paul Needham, Brian Jameson, Mark Fitz, Thomas Endicott, Don Wysoski, Chuck Carlson, Chris Hagebomber, and then in this segment I'd like to thank Rex Burkholter, Commissioner Serena Cruz, Katie Fast, Peter Murchie, State Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and Mike Graney. We brought you together today to get you an informative insight about how it is that you can make
change in your personal life, and that was covered in our Biofuel 101 segment, and then also how impact and change can be made at a larger level, at a city or state. And the reason why we put this together is because we believe that information provides options, and we believe options empowers the people. And so we give this information to you for you to put into your hands and see how is it that you're going to do next. And again, I'd like to thank my partner, Terry Hosaka, in this. Thank you, and have a great day. And also at 4 o'clock, well, actually about now, the straight veggie conversion workshop is occurring, and we've actually moved its location. It's actually occurring in the parking lot. So you can find the biodiesel co-op vehicle out there, and he can get you a hands-on instruction on how it is that you can make change. This is also going to be able to be available live stream on the web on KBOO's website, so you could actually download the program from there as well. Thank you.